We made this.
Hello everyone and welcome to The Time Is Now, Soylent Green is People. My name is Kurt North and welcome again to our Season 3 coverage of Millennium. We are part of the We Made This Podcast Network, and with me to talk about this episode today is Adam Chamberlain, returning after a couple of episodes off. Hello Adam, how are you doing today, mate?
Hello, I'm doing very well. Very glad to be back. Thanks for having me back. How are you?
It's a pleasure to have you back. I am very warm and very... sweaty. It's yes. The hottest day of the year, I think, in the UK today. So it's and I've been in a non-air conditioned room all day as well, so I've been struggling quite a bit. Well, how about yourself? Have you managed the onslaught of this UK heat, which we're just not used to in this country, are we?
Yeah, no, we're not. And I know much the same. So I'm in an apartment as well that's a loft conversion, so I have too many windows, it gets very hot, and I've been on teleconferences and things all day, so I've had to have windows closed, fans off to prevent noise, and so I'm in pretty much the same situation as you. Yes.
Yeah, well, the quicker they get noise reduction through apps and stuff, the better.
Yes.
Because I'm in a room as well, like with nothing. It's just stale air and myself. It's not nice. So to combat this, we decided to watch an episode of Millennium, which is quite dark and melancholy, which is always good. But bear with us as well, because I have seen on my lightning storm map that we had a bit of a storm last night, and there is some strikes happening about 100 miles away from me at the moment, so hopefully the electrics will stay on and we won't get any flash flooding, so we should be all right.
That'll be good.
So we are here today to talk about Through a Glass Darkly, which was written by Patrick Harbison. It was directed by Thomas J. Wright, and it is Season 3, Episode 7, and it was released on the 13th of November 1998. So before we begin, we'll just go through a couple of things, really. We wanted, I know that we spoke off air just now, and we just wanted to talk a little bit about Patrick Harbison. So what do you make to Patrick? He's had quite a career, hasn't he?
Quite a career, and quite an interesting career. So he's, I think he's ex-military before he even had a writing career. But then he started writing for UK shows, shows such as Heartbeat, I think, before he moved to the US. And I think Millennium was the first show he worked on there, but then has a whole list of great shows that he's worked on since, which is like ER, 24, Homeland, Dark Angel, I think you mentioned as one.
I mean, I mentioned Dark Angel. It gave me a blast from the past. That I was like, oh, I haven't seen Dark Angel. That was a show and a half. Lasted 20 episodes or something like that. Anyway, it didn't last very long.
Right. So then he came back and he wrote a show. We wrote a show in the UK that bears a number of similarities to Millennium, called Wire in the Blood, that some people may have heard of as well. And it's kind of interesting how he took some of the learnings from Millennium back to that series in terms of how he approached it. It was an adaptation of a series of novels by the crime writer Val McDermott, but he was keen to bring a different tone and some learnings from Millennium to that show. So yeah, he's had an interesting career and a very successful career.
Yeah, I mean, and this probably won't translate to our American audience, but that starred Robson Green, who was quite well known in the late 90s, and obviously this was 2002, this TV show came out. I'll admit I haven't seen it. I wasn't aware of it until you spoke to me just before. But I'm just thinking now of a potential episode, say like Goodbye Charlie, where Robson Green singing Unchained Melody.
There you go.
Which I think would be fantastic.
That could work.
Yeah, exactly. Sorry for those American folk who probably don't get that. So I apologise for that. Yeah, so, I mean, he did obviously Person of Interest as well. And, you know, so he's had a decent writing career. And it's interesting how his relation to Millennium is as well, isn't it? Because he was in for the first season for Broken World. That was the one with the horses, wasn't it, Broken World?
And that was a co-write, so, I think, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was Carl and Adam that covered that episode way back in season one when we were just younglings. But he also obviously then did this one and obviously moved on to the rest of season three. So it is an interesting. He's got interesting viewpoints on both season one and season three. Really, doesn't he?
He does. Yeah. And he. So I don't think he was super familiar with the series when he came on to season one, but it was Michael Duggan that brought him onto the writing staff in season three, and Michael Duggan who left shortly after several episodes in, as many folks will know, and he comments how he hadn't really established a working relationship with Chip Johannessen at that point, and it took him some time to really get the show under Chip Johannessen, what it would turn into, and he has a great quote. So there's an interview that people can find on Eat the Corn. This is an interview done about 10 years ago for This Is Who We Are, but it's archived on Eat the Corn, and he talks about how the series became a gentler, more mysterious, more inquiring animal under Chip Johannessen, which I think is a great description for season three.
Yeah, I suppose it is. Yeah, I mean, Chip Johannessen obviously did Force Majeure, and as he obviously takes season three on, I'm sure that once we get kind of beyond episode 12, that we'll see more and more of that, and some of the kind of way that we move into season three, which is interesting in itself, really.
Yeah, and absolutely. I mean, he talks about it as a highlight of his career, as many people do that worked on Millennium, and he also talks about how he was given more freedom in terms of what he was writing than pretty much any job he's done before or since, which is interesting. Interesting too. There's some very interesting stuff in this article actually about The Sound of Snow, which is my favorite episode of the season that he wrote. I won't get into it because I know you're going to get into that a little later in this run, but how that episode came about, some of the elements of that episode that perhaps didn't come about in the order you might think, but so it's a good article worth checking out. But and he talks specifically about this episode and how it was being pushed down the running order quite alarmingly, he says, until Chris Carter had actually took an episode that was planned off the slate, and they were looking around for an episode that was ready to go into production, and Through a Glass Darkly was, and hence found its way into the schedule at this point in the season.
I think I've mentioned this in previous episodes. I don't know can't remember if it was with yourself or not, but the fact that Carter's still having this involvement, even though he's having to go between LA and Vancouver, is interesting in itself, and the fact that he's still that. Even though he's still there, he's a bit distant, but he still has that power to actually pull episodes like that and get them organised that way.
Yeah, I think we did talk about it last time I was on, because Chris Carter had talked a lot about the extent to which he wanted to get back involved in the series, and I can only imagine the schedule that he had just running one network TV show, but it. I guess the sense I get is that he wasn't quite as involved in the long run as he might have liked to have been. But as you say, clearly was still making key decisions such as this one.
Yeah. So what do you think too? Let's dive into the episode then, and let's see how what we think about this, and just give a general overall view. So what do you think too? This episode as a whole, and what would you personally rate out of 10? Because there's wide reaction to this episode, to say the least, and I'll touch upon that shortly. But what do you personally make of this episode yourself?
Yeah, it's not one of the best episodes of the season or of the run to me by any means, but neither do I think it is a disaster as some people do. So I would probably give it a 7 out of 10. I made a comment the last time I was on that I think it's you'll do best to approach season 3 on its own terms, and I will live up to that mantra in my approach to this episode. So there are some things that I think that I do have problems with in terms of the the core setup of the episode, which I'm sure we'll get into. But I think there's some interesting stuff going on here, and I think it's there's something about the tone and the look of the episode that I quite like. Feels very season one Millennium in lots of ways, but I do quite like it. So yeah, 7 out of 10 for me.
Yeah, I would. Yeah, I'm probably about the same. There's a lot to like. There's a lot to find within it. I think if you give it a chance, then there's a lot to take away and think about, which I particularly like. I tend to track more towards the melancholy with TV shows and episodes anyway. So, as you know, taking the subject matter aside a little bit, there is a darkness to this one, which kind of draws me in a little bit with you know, some of the actual potentials of human evil and things like that, which, as you mentioned, plays back to season one. I mean, it's interesting, the IMDb, because I know that I've mentioned this, that IMDb scores obviously tracked down quite a lot in season three. So you're looking at around 200 votes, and they stay pretty much around there. The Kiss one gets a bit of a jump, gets to 216. And I talked about that a couple of weeks ago. And I'm not going to say any more to that. but this one actually ticks up. So Skull and Bones, and I think Darren Mooney's alluded to this a few times on the X-Cast as well, that you'll sometimes get an episode where things will uptick because of the week before.
Right.
But Skull and Bones got a 7.6 last week, which was out from 182 votes. And this one actually ticks up to 7.8. So it's actually, it's not too bad. And then Human Essence drops down significantly after that, which in itself will be interesting next week. Mm. So it is. I mean, there's a lot of different things going on in this episode. So it just in theory, where does it get knocked down for you? What are the particular elements that you don't feel kind of connect right with this episode?
There's mainly one element, and that's really at the very core of it, which is the whole idea of the lawyer, Jarrett, being able to manipulate Brunelli in the way that he does, and to have the opportunity to do so. Just that, which I appreciate, is at the very sort of heart of the setup of the episode. I just don't buy it. It feels contrived, and there are certainly elements in which, as an audience member, I think you can feel a little manipulated into making certain assumptions about Brunelli and about the episode that are borne out to be false as you go along, and I think you're manipulated into thinking those things. But also, I do think that's interesting in and of itself, in terms of how quickly people leap to judgment. And viewing this episode in 2020, how judgmental people can be. And yes, I feel manipulated, but I think that it's also perhaps making a point as to how easily manipulated we are to come to certain conclusions.
Yeah, I think the way that this portrays that I would agree in some ways with that, because it Frank Black basically says three lines or three words in relation to, like, sort of the the memory kind of aspect to it, and it's not really looked into it anymore. It's just like, oh, it's false memories. It's like, right. there is a bit of that towards the end of the episode when we've got Brunelli with Max, and not that they're both the same people, Jarrett and Max together. That would be good, wouldn't it? when he's trying to manipulate him into that role, and it does feel a bit forced, and there's elements there which don't really connect. I also personally think that he's a bit too stock as a bad guy in some ways. It's almost like signposted a little bit towards him.
Right,
but overall, I think that's where I would come from. I think there's other things, and I'll get into this in more detail later. But there's kind of things like just the brush over of the reason, the cycle of abuse that kind of the well-worn lock did, and it's just really just brushed over. I mean, this wasn't recorded at the time when Joseph Fritzl was on the loose, and well, obviously the 24 years that poor girl spent in the basement for so long, but that just seems to be a side note. And it's like, well, yes, it's horrible, but it just seems to be, it was a throwaway line, and I felt that was a bit, he could have worked on that a bit more.
Yeah, it's a fair comment. I think, yeah, it is somewhat, as you say, brushed over.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think it's by design, because as you say, you're manipulated to, like, think it's one thing, and then you're finding out it's a whole different thing by the last act.
Yes.
So it's by design, but I just think it's like, okay, that's a bit of a cheap way out.
Yes.
So, but yeah, but it's interesting. So let's dive into it in more depth then, and just go through the episode through a glass darkly. Right, so we start off in what I think is actually quite a good teaser, really, with the 1979, you know, kind of thing, and the use of the three blind mice and the all the attributes, in talking about being led down a path of thinking this is what it is.
Yeah.
But it is quite an interesting opening, really, isn't it?
It is, and you say you're led to think certain things, but there are some, I don't know, I guess there are some little clues here. The fact that, so as Brunelli approaches Shannon?
This was Case.
Casey.
Don't worry, I'm going to do this all episode as well. So Casey... Yeah, Casey was 1979.
Yes,
yeah.
Sorry. Approaches her and she's crying already. So, again, there is that melancholy, the fact that she's singing Three Blind Mice, which took for granted as a child, but you listen back to it and ponder on the lyric of that now and you think, oh, that's really quite unpleasant in and of itself. It's not the nicest of nursery rhymes.
Well, we've talked about that back in Monster as well.
Oh, yes.
So, yeah, so it seems to be a recurring theme, which again, I suppose, is another link, isn't it, really? But
Yeah. So, and it's, there's a lot about this episode and I guess even slightly this playground, there's a lot that feels very dilapidated about it. There's a certain visual look to it. I think you get it right from the off. There's a sort of dirtiness and unkempness and what have you to so much, even that the look that Brunelli has and everything that really does set a particular tone that really, I mean, the melancholic tone that you've touched on as well. So it really does set the mood, and it's does really set you up for what you think you know going into the episode itself.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to jump around a little bit just because as things come into my head, the one of the things that I find really interesting over the course of this episode is the as I say, the dilapidation, but then we see in the sunshine views that he's obviously seeing, and that
yes.
And what one of the particular thing that I find interesting is the empathy that it's kind of portraying through Brunelli. I quite like that aspect of when we do find out what it is that you know he's doing it to protect him. We'll talk about that later, but the fact that he's seeing these girls through that prism, and you know, and it's something that we see throughout the course of the episode. And it's a tone in itself, the way that the kind of flick between the two, because she's happy at the time in which he's seen her,
and I do quite like that, and I think it's so again, you're manipulated at the beginning to think that there's something creepy about it, but actually, again, that's something that we're projecting onto it. You could view those images that he has and the sort of sunshine dappled and smiley and all the rest of it, that just this sort of idealized view of childhood that he has, and perhaps a sort of childhood that he's never experienced himself, as you very much get the impression of too. So I think there's perhaps more going on than we might realize at first as a viewer, at least on first viewing of this episode. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, just touching upon that then, because you kind of when we see Max and Brunelli, Max and Brunelli, I don't know why I'm doing this for this episode, honest to God. When we see Brunelli and the reaction he has with his dad, because that's an interesting one in itself, that his dad is kind of portrayed, and again, this is probably a part of the episode I'm not particularly fond of, is that we don't see enough of him. We don't seem to it seems to be just like a one line. And the final shot of him being run over, and
yes,
and that's it. But you get this impression that he hasn't really had a childhood. His dad didn't want to give him a childhood, and that he wants, he's almost like living through that, through the girl that he's trying to come to.
Exactly. And there's also the scene later on in the house where, between Frank and, Brunelli's father, where he's come and painted the mural back on the bedroom wall. And there's that short conversation where Frank gets a sense of the fact that, yeah, he's not been a particularly, good father. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. And it's not lost to me as well. It was a yellow house.
Yes. I like that. Yeah. And Frank, he glances at it for you can just imagine what's going through his head because he looks at it for quite some time, doesn't he? The house itself,
yeah. Which then leads to the fact that which again it goes back to effectively what we're going to get in the next scene. So when we do come out of the actual trailer and we see the girl that's lying there, that was again we're going to go bad with names. I think that was Shannon. And then we come to the present day and Frank is actually coming to this hearing to basically say that he can't stay there. It's interesting in itself that, you know, throughout this episode that we've portrayed Frank as someone who's wrong. And I like that. I like the way they approach that because that's not something that many writers, especially in 1013, if you look at Mulder generally is right, you know, 95% of the time.
Yes.
And you'd think that, you know, majority of the time, Frank Black is always like the going back to the season one kind of Western style. He's the one that's going to ride in and whatever. But it's trying to sidestep you. But at the same time, he does eventually over the course of this episode admit that, you know, actually I was wrong. And I like that. And I like the connection with the yellow house and stuff.
Yeah. I like the way in that Frank is given in this episode because it's quite a novel way in that we don't often see where he's called as a forensic psychologist to give a view to the parole board on Max Brunelli, which is actually a large part of what forensic psychologists do. We think they're out there profiling and so on and so forth, but actually a lot of it is around sort of rehabilitation and so on. So it feels quite a sort of true way in for the episode. But again, you feel manipulated as a viewer because you're like, hey, if Frank Black thinks that he's definitely guilty and likely to commit these crimes again, then he must be right. So we're quite right as an audience to think the same thing. But I don't think it's implied that he wasn't part of the original investigation. So he's just been asked to come in and make an assessment for his release, I think, or at least, I guess at least it's not clear, but don't get the sense that he was involved in the original investigation, or I didn't anyway, certainly in terms of how he revisits interview footage and so on later, as you say, and then comes to change his mind.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think I'm not. Yeah, because there's also the scene, isn't there, in the field when he says, "Why weren't we made aware that the girl in the when Casey was in the on the swing that was a happen chance that wasn't something that was predicted."
Yeah.
And he actually he seems quite upset at that point. You know, so why weren't we told this? This is obviously vital information to him. And I suppose that's Frank's way out of. You know, the fact that had he known that information, he might have foreseen the case differently had he been in that situation.
Yeah, had he been involved. So that's certainly the sense I get. And so don't judge Frank too harshly for being wrong at the beginning.
He's just going off the evidence that he's been given.
Exactly.
So, and as we know from previous episodes, especially in the one that we covered recently, in The End of the World as We Know It, that, you know, Frank is very meticulous about his evidence.
Yes, absolutely.
So he wouldn't miss something like that. And I think that's a nice little touch, actually, if we're looking at, you know, over the season, these things that were pulling together from probably nothing. Yeah. But... But the fact that he is, you know, there's gaps in his knowledge in this one, and you know, he can only portray that, and he is mistaken. So this is where it's a difficult conversation to have. It's very brave to put this type of thing on screen, and as you say, that especially with the way we are modern day. But when Brunelli returns to Lang Creek, I think it's called, or to Lane Creek. He comes off the bus, and then we get this kind of mob mentality of them basically saying, "I've been you're here. I have to tell you that we have to tell people, you know, the sex register or whatever it may be in America or in the UK or whatever." And these next few scenes showcase the kind of the reaction to him and the fact that he's been released from jail. He's been in there for 20 years. something as heinous as this crime that he's been convicted for. We must remember that he has been convicted for it at this point. Mm-hmm. But the people's reaction to it is really telling, that, you know, to have something like this on screen. And this comes to my first part about the way that Emily Vandervoort says in an AV Club review, as this Millennium episode is basically misery porn. So, and I get the reason why she says that, but I think for me, it's actually brave to be able to put something like this on screen and try and work it in a way that does have, you know, it isn't trying to be sensationalist about it. It's trying to be real life in some ways.
It is, and actually the fact that so Brunelli is this sort of archetypal character that's a little bit of an outsider. He's a, you know, sort of portrayed as being a little bit sort of slow perhaps, and so on. He's an easy victim to be cast as the outsider and to be on the receiving end of this stuff, whereas actually I think that one of the other truths about the episode here is in terms of the fact that the real abuser here is comes from within a family unit, and there's abuse going on within the family unit too, and we don't like to think about child abuse in that way, but it's often the sad, horrible reality of it. So again, I think there's I don't agree with that characterization of misery porn or whatever, but I think there is there's a truth, there are a number of truths at the heart of this episode, and that's one of them, as is this sort of mob mentality that sadly feels just as truthful today as back in the late 90s when this episode first aired.
Yeah, I think you touched on something quite interesting there, because as you say, the character of the dad and him not having a childhood and stuff like that, and then you see what he's actually wearing later on when Frank actually speaks to him at the swings, and yes, he pulls off his top and things. It's like, it's a really like sort of worn down t-shirt and stuff like that. And it's, as you say, it's, I suppose that's kind of where the episode is trying to get towards, isn't it? It's kind of going, look, you know, it's not what you think. You know, you may be led down one path, but it is actually the path of, you know, as I say, the family unit. And this is where I think the well-worn lock kind of like emanates a little bit through the episode, with the fact that, you know, you've got the powerful man in Mr. Bangs in that episode.
Yes.
And you've got obviously the lawyer in this episode as well. So they're both foreseen as powerful men.
Yes, absolutely. So absolutely. Yeah. And people.
Even though he is kind of like the actual stylized version of this lawyer, it does have hints of, you know, he's not potentially there. So.
Yes, absolutely.
Which is interesting in itself.
Yeah, I have to say, even in the episode's title, sorry, I guess there's a clue right there. So it's a biblical reference through a glass darkly, but this idea of obscured reflection, or seeing a distortion, seeing things through a distorted lens, is very much that's how Brunelli is being seen, and that's how all these people who are making judgments about him, that's their perspective on him is. Yeah. It's there in the title.
It is, yeah. And then on the flip side, just going back to the fact that Brunelli is seeing these images that are not what we would expect, what we're actually seeing.
Yes.
And I like the introduction of the Holy Family and the St. Joseph like medallions later on, where, you know, he's using it as a protection. You know, he's trying to protect these girls. He knows that they may well be in danger. From, you know, on some level, but I don't think he himself knows what level, because of this, like, you know, these false memories that apparently he's been getting. So
yes, absolutely. What, one of the things, so you reference these scenes where he gets abused, and there's the scene with his father outside the grocery store. Just as a throwaway, something that I noticed on rewatching this. I don't think I noticed the first time around when I watched it, but I noticed it watching it again recently. It's the fakest bag of groceries I think I've ever seen on screen that he drops outside the store there.
It's a proper eggs, milk, bread.
but it's also the fact that they're clearly all empty packages. He's going to be furious when he gets those groceries home and realizes there's no eggs in the egg box, and there's no milk in that carton of milk or anything. Yeah. The way they bounce on the ground. Anyway, sorry, it's just a detail.
No, it's fine. I didn't notice. I did notice it was like, well, that's a traditional looking bag of like groceries, but everyone goes out for milk, bread, and yes, you know, eggs and stuff like that. So it's interesting. So Brunelli's brought into questioning, and There is an interesting thing in this, the fact that they actually instantly go to him without any kind of evidence,
yes,
without anything at all. They just kind of like, they bring him in. They instantly check the area where he last left the trail, in the trailer from 20 years ago. And then what I struggle with a little bit is the way that the lawyer does come straight in and defends him, because he defends him on the radio as well. And yes, I know it's kind of more of a cover of this life, but it's just interesting how there's no real sense. And again, it's the way I think the episode's designed, that, you know, he's doing that for a reason. It does come across as fairly plain laced and, you know, well, he's doing this, he's doing that.
It does. Absolutely. Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. Yeah.
So what did you think to the wildflowers then? Because obviously this is just a way for Emma Hollis. And I think Emma actually in this episode has a few bits where she, you know, she does the investigative work and, you know, and gives Frank the information that he needs, because it's obviously there's bits like the movement of the body and things, you know, yes, where it's like she's done the investigating and has told Frank, and Frank is now led down that path.
Yes.
I thought it's nice little touch that.
It is. She does a lot. And again, you always get the sense with Emma Hollis that she, like Frank, she has that attention for detail, that eye for detail. Again, we talked about it in The End of the World as We Know It, but she's clearly very adept herself. The wildflowers, again, there's something about that... it's melancholic tone, and it all feeds into this view that Frank slowly forms, that actually, you know, here's Brunelli, he's revisiting scenes, he's making his peace, and so on and so forth. And slowly these clues that Emma brings help him to piece that together, or help them to piece it together.
So when we do get to, there's a couple of bits within the next few scenes where, you know, get Brunelli's released from jail, and you've got things like, you know, the fact that we see some of the trademarks of the matchstick. That seems to be, the recurring theme is the matches being burnt out and using the ash to do the drawings, and what, yes, the lawyer does, that which is in itself is quite interesting from that.
It is. I don't know how someone gets a box of matches when they're in a jail cell. That seemed a bit odd to me, that you'd have access to matches like that. But anyway, but it is. So again, it feels a bit of a contrivance.
When it's burnt into the plot. When it's burnt into the plot, it's fine.
That's how. But yeah, it is a nice detail that again, yeah, Frank, when he's viewing back those videos later, it's one of those things he picks up on that's very telling. Yeah,
and it brings us to the bit in the park, like I was saying before, with when he does take his top off, and his development of the religion. And we mentioned Saint Joseph before, and the fact that, you know, he's given the girl a medal, Saint Joseph medal, which is a medal of like protection, and he foresees that as like the way of helping. And he basically says here about how God has been testing him, which is. And we get it early on as well, obviously, with the first part, and they were saying about, is it a holding pattern? And actually the holding pattern is something a lot worse than what he was doing. But it's it's a really interesting thing that he has total belief in, that he has been tested, and that he survived that test, and now he's come out the other side.
Yeah, it is. Absolutely. He talks about having been abused by 4 men, 8 men, 12. And the 12 men, whether that's a 12 men disciples allusion to Christ and so on. And you get all this sort of religious, this somewhat obtuse religious references. But I think that's a really the core scene, isn't it? That scene between Brunelli and Frank in the park there. And Frank has that line where he's really empathizing with him and recognizes something in Brunelli and says, you know, I know what it is to suffer and to feel guilt. And so he recognizes something there in Brunelli, which isn't the profile that he was relying on for his account to the parole board, which, and incidentally, he's not wrong in all of that, where he starts talking about saying, you know, high recidivism and everything that plays out, but obviously he's just talking about somebody else. He doesn't realize it at the time, but you can see Frank here starting to get more of a sense of this person being not who he's being characterized as at all.
Yeah, and what's interesting from the kind of a religious aspect, I mean, there's the Yellow House is obviously linking in with the fact that, you know, it's the theme of them two kind of realizing that they've got some familiarity between the two of them. Frank basically says, you know, I don't think you did it kind of thing, pretty much. But then what do you think to the religious aspects here? Because, you know, it might have been quoted scripture back in season one. This is more abstract, and yes, there is a link with the holy, you know, the St. Joseph Holy Church and whatever. It's just more, it's more loose than what some of the season would be in season one.
It is looser and more vague in a way that I guess I don't know quite how much to take from it, to be honest, or quite whether there's more references in some of the words that Brunelli uses, whether to read more into it than simply here's someone who's found a faith and relates to the idea of suffering and so on through it. I mean, again, the title of the episode, Through a Glass Darkly, that's a quote from Corinthians.
13, but, is it? Yeah, something.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, first book of Corinthians 13. I don't know how much you can read into it other than, as you say, these sort of loose religious allusions. It is more obtuse and loose, such that I'm not sure you could necessarily build a very deep analysis of the episode by putting all those pieces together. I certainly can't, anyway.
No, it's probably because it's not someone quoting scripture because of something that's happening. It's more, it's based on him wanting to protect and kind of finding faith and finding that whole aspect, isn't it, rather than anything else, really. You know, I mean, we might touch upon it in end of season two, for example. There's elements there which might have been a bit looser, and you know, so I can see the reasons for it. I just found it interesting that, I mean, talking about the season one analogy, it does feel like a season one, you know, the links, like, as I say, well, worn lock and whatever. So you do have that kind of connection. What always jumps out at me whenever I watch this episode, I must admit, as I rated it as a 7, it's one of those episodes where when I was coming to go through the list and looked at the title, I was like, do I remember that one? And then I quickly got the GIF file ready just to post for the actual mailbag for later on. Mm-hmm. And I looked at it and I was like, don't really remember too much about this one. But what I do remember when I did actually sit down to watch it is the knowing looks that we get from Brunelli. And I think that was really effective, the way he kept looking over and the way Frank kind of sees that interplay between the two of them.
Yes, absolutely.
But even like the rewatch as well, when I think even watched on the first viewing, that as things you start to remember, when they were actually in the room itself before he saw the review, you saw that look, and Frank does actually go, no, I'm not quite sure that there's something quite
what
right
just happened
there.
Yeah, exactly. And that, some of those touches, I think, are to the episode's credit. And as you say, when you go back and rewatch, you pick some of these little moments up. Absolutely. You talk about what you remembered from the episode, because again, as I mentioned last time, I'm less familiar with this season than the previous seasons. I've still seen the episodes several times over the years, but not as many times as the other seasons. And it was less the details than it was the tone of the look and tone of this episode that stuck with me. And so I kind of, it's strange that I had that sort of broader sense that it, that mood that it left me with, but not necessarily recalling all the finer details.
Yeah, I mean, Jordan in this, she's only in it for like the one scene. I think that's similar to what we've had in the past as well. But there is allusions to that. There's the seventh, all the sevens again come up in the actual voicemail, and that seems to just get dropped. It doesn't really go anywhere apart from just like pointing us towards Jordan and Jordan's nightmare, which was effective scene in itself. But the fact that it's like being asked to forgive him, and again, that probably seeds into everything that we're seeing. It's nice that Harbinson's put these little bits in that are thematically linked with Frank, and you know, this is probably the I'd say maybe the first real one that we've had of that post, you know, post The Time Is Now, really, because there's little bits in, you know, the Exogenesis and Innocence,
right,
and stuff, and there wasn't that much in the one we covered. And then obviously Skull and Bones is more about what the millennium did.
Mm-hmm.
And then obviously, you know, we've got 13 Years Later, which I won't ever talk about ever again. and then we've got this one, but this one kind of like sort of just layers in just those little bits behind the background, which is very thematically linked. And I think that's a nice little touch, that maybe something that might maybe get overlooked.
Yeah, it is. And again, subtle. And it's there. And then we move on. But it, like I said, all slowly builds up this sort of deeper, perhaps understanding we get of Jordan and her own empathy, that will come through later in the season. Yeah.
I mean, do you think that works? So, I mean, obviously we're going to talk about it later in the season. Do you think that works as a starting point here, really, in some ways that, you know, as a way to go, that Jordan was treated like really well in season three from that regard about her potential gift?
I think she is, and I think it is layered in well with a sort of, it's seeded here and in one or two other places to then revisit later on, that sort of rewards your regular viewer. So yes, I do think she has a great arc. It's probably her, Jordan's best season, without a doubt, this season in terms of where we take her, and especially some of the later episodes to come. And I think it's quite effective, as you said, just to sow the seeds here quite subtly and then move on. It's there in the background, as you can say. It could be easily overlooked in this episode.
So there's not much more to really talk about. I mean, we talked about the videotape, the fact that, you know, Frank kind of notices these little bits, and he's putting everything together now. Now he's got all the information, like we said, with the bike, when the bike goes, the girl on the bike goes missing, that, you know, and following that investigation, they eventually find out that, you know, it's the original one that didn't tell the story like they should have. And if Frank had that information, he would have known. This could have been stopped 20 years earlier. We also got there's a scene within that as well, which I just wanted to, again, kind of a Thomas J. Wright's signature, really. There was a great scene where Emma's coming out of the forest, and you see Frank in the background with the police car, and it's all fogged up.
Yeah,
so I just thought was a telling image that I kind of half remember as well.
You could have flipped this episode on, been flipping channels, and just happened across this episode, and within seconds you know you're watching Millennium, even if Lance hadn't shown up on screen.
Yeah, and I'm pretty sure we pretty much get that kind of view or that image in The X-Files as well, with John Doggett at some point as well. It just reminds me of that as well. But yeah, so when we've got, like, Brunelli, he's disappeared, and we join the family. This is where the turning point, this is the final act and the turning point, where we find that about the false memories, and it was actually Randall Jarrett who was the person, and Frank realizes that Julie isn't Jarrett's only daughter. And this is where, again, I mentioned it before, but this is where it kind of like it takes a really dark seed. This is the misery porn bit, I think, in some ways. And as I say, I mentioned Joseph Fitzel before, which is, you know, this predates our knowledge of that by 10 years. I think it was 2008 then that came out. But but something as horrible and as like getting out of your seat and out of your comfort zone completely, and just not, and really making you feel horrible and just icky.
Yeah.
It kind of just felt to me like it's difficult to explain whether or not I would want more of, not an explanation, but more of an inclination of what to do. Or was this enough? Was this enough to go, right, you know, there's more to this than just thing. This is the reason why there isn't been a holding cycle, because he's been treating this other daughter that way.
Yes. I don't think that it necessarily needed to go into more detail. It's all there, all that you need to know, even down to the fact that that his wife has been complicit in some way. She clearly seemed to know. She sent the daughter away, and clearly she knew why she sent the daughter away. So, again, for all for the treatment that Brunelli gets, that actually here this family that's supposedly, you know, to this point seen as a respectable family, this is where the real evil lies and has been hidden and buried and so on. Yeah,
I just think again, I'll go back to what I said earlier. I think it's the turnabout that's so quick, it's like when Frank goes, "Have you got a basement?" It's like, well, where did that? I know where it came from, but you know, it comes at you so quickly.
Yes,
that it's like, right, it's not Brunelli, it's him, right? Yeah. Okay, right, okay. So this is where we're going, and then it quickly moves on and moves on from there. And that's, I know what you mean with this, with the actual theme and look of the show, because this episode is quite dark, and I don't mean that from a thematic point of view. I mean from an actual filming point of view. It's actually quite a dark episode. There's not much light within some of the scenes at this point as well, and even to a point where I actually struggled to see some bits.
Right. Yes.
Which I thought was telling, because Thomas J. Wright's obviously a dab hand at this point, and maybe that's the way they wanted to go with it. But when we do get back to the house and we have the scene with Randall and Brunelli, and Brunelli's doing trying to relate this false memory to him, do you think that was effective? Could you see that was the way everything came together? Do you think that worked as a piece?
Not particularly well. If you're going to try and implant memories to someone, I'm not sure this is quite the way to do it. I think Darren Brown would probably have a slightly different approach, for instance. But it does feel a little rushed and a little hammy by this whole section of the episode to me.
Yeah, because it kind of falls apart, doesn't it? Because it's like he's telling that then. When Frank gets there, there's a small fight scene, you know, with the wooden thing, and Brunelli comes in and helps, and then Frank says, "Come and help me." Just leave him on the floor. He's just tried to attack them. No arrest, nothing like that. You know, just don't leave him on there. I know there's a woman, there's a girl there that needs medical attention. I get that, but it just didn't seem to be any urgency of, like, you know, eliminate the threat. You know, in any first aid, just from a first aid point of view, the first thing you look out for is danger.
Yes.
And having someone who's, you basically understand now to be a serial killer, who is lying on the floor because, you know, he's been attacked by somebody, and you leave him there, he's the epitome of danger.
He is, although it has been established that he's just left these. In the original case, 1979, the girl was left to die. So she died of thirst, which is pretty horrendous in itself. But that he hadn't actually, you know, taken a knife to them or whatever. So I guess I could sort of. Probably, if I tried hard enough, make a case for the fact that their priorities were right to actually attend to the girl. Probably on balance, I'd have to agree with you.
Yeah, well, that's interesting to say that, because that's something that I didn't factor in to bring up, and it's probably a good point to bring up, actually, is the the profile of him is that, you know, he didn't have the responsibility to do that.
Yes.
And that in itself was kind of like, I've not heard that ever said anywhere else before. Yeah. Not that I've, in my knowledge anyway,
yeah,
of this, like, not taking onus of a responsibility for what he's done. He's kind of like, you know, disowned it by inaction. And that in itself is kind of like, thinking about it is like, oh, right, okay, this is, that is dark. That is the kind of like, psychologically, you know, kind of telling, you know, and something that I don't think many shows would do, many procedurals definitely wouldn't, like, go down that route, but psychologically it makes sense.
It does, yeah. I mean, he's evaded responsibility for the crime and actually ruined Brunelli's life to pin it on him, and evades the responsibility of actually sort of, you know, taking a life or whatever. It's just, yeah, it's not a nice man.
Not a nice
summary.
So finally, there's a couple of scenes right at the end. We've got the dad with one car light off, which I thought should have been the other side, but never mind. And he runs over him. Now there's two trails of thought, either he was planning on running him down or not. It doesn't look like he was. I'm just being a bit facetious there, but then then we get the final scene where he's actually living with his dad now, and that almost like a you know, a reunion of sorts, that, you know, he wasn't the man he fought. Mm. But at the same time, this is where I think the dad doesn't come in quite right, because there's no real sign that they would ever have that kind of relationship, even with everything that's happened or not happened.
It's only jumped a few steps, haven't they, in that? I mean, it does seem a remarkable coincidence that they, so Brenny goes out and walks into the street, and lo and behold, the first car that comes along and runs it down is his father. Mm. Like you say, I don't think there's anything deliberate about it, but it does seem an odd coincidence that I'm not sure you can really get away with in terms of the narrative. And then, yeah, I mean, I guess you can imagine there had been some sort of reconciliation, and the father's understood that he's been wrong, and then having put his own son in hospital, that perhaps there's been some sort of reconciliation of sorts that finds them living together. It's almost a happy ending, and as much as you can claim a happy ending for an episode like this, in terms of the children leaving the basket on the doorstep and so on. There's something redemptive about that for Max Brunet, at least.
Yeah, and I think by talking through this, I think this is probably where I feel it's probably the weakest part. The episode itself is actually quite slow, but I actually like the pacing of it. I actually quite like that pacing. But then everything at this end, these last 5-10 minutes, just seems so rushed. It just seems like everything's just, you know, let's wrap this up.
Yeah.
You know, and it doesn't have time to breathe. But the way that the draft, or the way that the story is told and written, I mean, I don't know from a production point of view how far along this episode would have been written, you know, and being that the fact they had to pull it forward into production.
Yeah, but I think they pulled it forward into production because it was already written, and then, and therefore found its way into the schedule. But yeah, to what extent that then needed rewrites, to what extent, how heavily it needed to be edited, what sort of length it ran to or something. Maybe there's some stuff that got lost in the edit. I don't know.
Yeah, it just, I mean, this is just I'd say my personal opinion, that it just feels like, you know, they've gone for this like telling of a story, which is like, the basic fable is that you don't believe, you know, the things that seem obvious to you, because there's maybe another undertelling. I think you hit it on the head really with the family unit. You would expect that to be the nice loving home.
Yeah.
And then you've got a broken family with just a dad and a son who don't speak to each other. And it's actually, you know, the other way around. You know, there's a lot of horror and a lot of depth to the horrors of family life in that way. And, you know, what you see on the front isn't exactly what may necessarily be the truth.
Yeah.
And I get that. And I just think it maybe falters because of it. Because then the ending has to be rushed, and, you know, you can't delve in. I'm not saying I would like to see what he did in that basement and stuff like that, because I'm not saying that. What I think it maybe could have had a bit more depth to that in some way. Yeah. And then obviously the dad's kind of reconciliation just seems so quick.
Yes.
And the fact we've literally only seen him in a bedroom talking about the painting.
Yes.
A slap. Yeah. And then, you know, the end, and it's just the characterization just felt a little bit off to me.
Yeah, it's not really been earned, has it, by what we've seen on screen. It feels a bit of a jump. You have to fill in the gaps.
Yeah. I mean, it'd be interesting to see kind of a novelization of it, you know, because it would definitely be able to envelop more of it. I just think that maybe potentially this wasn't the right medium for it to really work on that back end. I did feel a little bit rushed. But yeah, so that brings the episode to an end. Any final thoughts before we have a very quick look into the mailbag?
So I would be interested just to, if I can, go back to just referencing what Patrick Harbinson did next after Millennium. Because it's kind of interesting. So we talked a bit about Warren in the Blood, and the fact that when he approached that series, and again, it was an adaptation from a series of books, and he deliberately, they said they wanted to change the character. The character's called Tony Hill in Wearing the Blood, to make him less dark. And it was almost like a reaction to the character of Frank Black. And they made him this sort of funny, clumsy, muttering, as he says himself, character that I think it's later acknowledged that he has Asperger's, but But it's so strange. So he talks about how Millennium is very visual. And I think this episode, Through a Good Glass Darkly, is such a great example of how that sort of visual tone, as we talked about, that look that Millennium had, but also how Lance as a performer could do so much non-verbally. But yeah, having sat through this first episode of Wire in the Blood, which is called The Mermaid Singing, I think it's called, which, and incidentally, it's about a transsexual who is, a male to female transsexual who is deeply unsettled by his own sexuality. That there's all kinds of allusions to the Millennium pilot in just the storyline itself. Right. But you get this character who is, as opposed to having these sort of visual flashes that Frank has, and we get one or two of in this episode, he just talks incessantly to himself, and like he'll have a conversation sat in one chair, and then he'll go and sit in another chair, and it's like he's having a conversation with the killer to try and understand him, and it just doesn't work for me. It's almost comical, but it's not at all visual and doesn't work to everyone in the medium. And I watched that just after having watched this episode, the Through a Glass Darkly, the other day, and thought, wow, what a contrast in terms of, I think, how well Millennium works with this subject matter, and actually how tonally off something like Wire in the Blood was to me, just based on this one episode, where you get this sort of humorous character thrown into the center of it, who's seen as a little bit eccentric and odd, set against the sort of very dark material, not as dark as the material in this episode, I have to say, and it just doesn't work. So for as much as people criticize Millennium for being so unrelentingly dark, I think there's something in terms of the consistency of tone and how masterful the storytelling is in Millennium at its best, that I think just the counterpoint of those two, it really brought home to me. So.
Yeah. I mean, I struggle with that comment about it being dark, because it's, I think, for me, just for me as a, I can see the relentlessness, especially of season one, where people struggle, like, as you go through. And I've mentioned before, I couldn't binge watch, you know, five or six episodes in a row, because it's not that type of, but it's not that type of television, but I don't think it needs to be in itself. And I actually really like the darkness aspect to it. I actually think, you know, and sometimes the levity that people might want to bring into it. I mean, season two, obviously, for me, is my favorite season. But season one is not that far behind. It's literally a whisker behind.
Yes.
And that's considered a really, really dark season of television. But I actually love it for that reason.
I do. And I think it depends. So it's funny you say about not binge watching it. So I'm always trying to recruit new people to watch Millennium. I have several copies of Millennium on DVD, and I lend copies out. And just before the lockdown started, I lent this to a friend of mine who I thought it would appeal to. And she actually says she binge watched season one during lockdown with her mother, and they both absolutely loved it. So. So there you go. I guess some people can binge watch Millennium and get through it.
Before lockdown, this was like last year, I managed to persuade someone at work to watch it, and I gave them my DVDs to watch. And I purposely left them at the end of season two. And I said, I'm going to give you the first two seasons, and I'm going to leave it at season two. And I just want to give you like 4 or 5 weeks. I want to talk to you about the first two seasons. I think I gave him the first season, mm-hmm. and then said, I'm going to give you the second season, but I'm not going to give you the third one for a couple of weeks until you give it me back. And then we'll talk about season two as a whole, and see where it is, just because I, as you say, it takes season three on its own terms.
Mm-hmm.
And he himself said he enjoyed season three. So it's probably not as much as the other two, but he enjoyed it. But he did struggle a little bit. He did say he had to take it a bit of a time, but I suppose it's how you view it, really. But
yes.
But for me, I would struggle. I think we've probably mentioned this about the back end of it. You know, we get to like the weeds area. That's probably where it slows down a little bit.
Yes, yes.
But anyway, let's have a look in the mailbag then, if that's everything for yourself, and we'll have a quick look in the mailbag.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so let's do that now. Right, first of all, this wasn't a mailbag. This is my good friend and your good friend, Darren Mooney. Now, I often read his reviews before coming on, just to see what his take is. And as many people will know from last season, I didn't need to do that many times because he was on so much. But I thought this one was a particularly interesting one I wanted to mention, because he says, Through a Glass Darkly is a terrible piece of television. And I'll just read the first paragraph. There's no nice way to say it. There's no excusing it. Through a Glass Darkly is an absolute wretched script directed in a cloying manner. It is cliche, it's clumsy, it is trite. It is manipulative and cynical. There's no redeeming features to Through a Glass Darkly because of the fact it makes Human Essence and Almerta look significantly better than they actually are. This is an abysmal production and one of the worst 45 minutes of television that 1013 has broadcast at this point. It is up there with Excelsis Day. So that's what he's generally put. And he obviously, as Darren does, I would suggest anyone who has liked it so far, has listened to Darren on the podcast, please go on and read it, because he does make his comments, you know, kind of... backs them up and says it, and even mentions that that article that you mentioned before with Harbinson as well. So he does say that, but I think to liken it to Excelsis Day for me is too far.
Yeah, it's gone a little too far for me as well. Far be it for me to disagree with anything that Darren says, but I mean, as you say, that his reviews there, and I did read that review, and I've read all of his reviews there. They're always in depth, always well considered, and I will respectfully disagree that it has no redeeming qualities. I mean, I think that some of the points probably that we'd agree on in terms of the sort of manipulative nature of some of it, but I think it's going a little far for me to say it has no redeeming qualities. But like I say, far be it for me to disagree with Darren.
And I say I won't spoil it for those. In fact, he's actually got the one of the pictures on it is symbolism of the broken paper bag with the stock food, which is great. But as I say, I'll leave that to people to read, and then we shall go into just a couple of comments that were also made on here. So we've got one here saying, plot twist, not sure the premise is totally believable. And then Russ Hugo says, it's not perfect and slightly formulaic. But it is reasonably good throwback to a more empathy-focused season one. It's improved by some fairly strong performances that make it even more depressing. And I think that wraps it up in a few words that I would actually agree with, really. I mean, again, Russ is very opinionated on many different things, and I actually think that I'm probably aligned with him on this one.
Yep, me too, I think. Yep.
Yep. That was it for today. So that was the final comments on there. So we'll be back next week. I believe that you may well be back later in the season. Which you'll be seeing you on the likes of Nostalgia, which is a particular favourite of mine. I actually really like Nostalgia. So that'll be good. So we'll catch you later in the season. And I think you're on 7-1 as well, I believe. So those are two episodes to look out for. But until then, which is quite a few weeks down the line, so where can people find you online, and what are you up to, Adam?
So you can find me on Twitter, Adam_Chamberlain, just spelled BERLN at the end. I'm fairly active on Twitter, but nothing terribly exciting.
Mainly retweeting the Time Is Now podcast.
Yes, I certainly do lots of that. And also at fourthwarsonpress.com, where you can read a bit more about the book.
Okay, and you can find me in the usual places. So you've got my Red Dwarf podcast, which is at Red Dwarf Pod, and that's Shipwrecked and Comatose. You've got the X-Cast, the X_Cast. So over the summer, we did the Fight the Future Minute, which was a minute-by-minute podcast focusing on the Fight the Future film, the X-Files film from 1998, which was released around about 4 or 5 months before this episode. So that was us going minute by minute. So I'm on there with Darren on a couple of occasions, and with Tony Black, who was the runner of the X-Cast and obviously the executive producer of this show as well. And so those are the two places you can find me. When we get into the new year, hopefully when things have calmed down in the world, we will be getting some Star Trek Picard back. Hopefully season two will be at some point, maybe late 2021, maybe even early 2022. But anything comes out regarding that, I'll be covering on the Make It So podcast, which you can find at Jean-Luc Podard. So those are the three main areas you can find me. And of course, don't forget that I will be here next week for another The Time Is Now. We're rattling through these episodes now, so you know it's coming slowly to an end. But we do have some features coming up towards the end of the season as well. So there'll be a couple of specials, including maybe an X-Files Millennium crossover. I wonder what that could be. Yeah, but thank you very much, Adam, as again. So we'll see you later in a few weeks' time. But until next time, everyone, remember, this is who we are.
Elsewhere on We Made This.
We are Starfleet.
Honestly, it felt so great to see the Starship Discovery again.
Yeah, out of the frying pan and into the fire.
Right into the fire. So in our previous episode, I had commented on how I felt like all the dramatic tension that the writers built up with Burnham falling kind of felt like, all right. But here, I felt the exact opposite. It just seemed like the right blend of tension and risk and what's at stake.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head, and I think there's a couple of reasons for this. One, I think...
The Giddy Carousel of Pop.
So there's one particular thing where I think Sylvia just nails the Mannix, absolutely nails them, and nails them to this day. And she says, the Mannix mission is a simple one. They want to make music exciting, glamorous, and interesting again. Make people wake up out of the boredom and meaninglessness of 20th century life and jump up and down to some good old rock and roll music and think about things and have a laugh, because at the end of the day, none of us will ever be happy. And I had to have everything about them immediately.
The Movie Palace.
Before we even think about the book, I suppose, were you coming to this as a Marilyn Monroe fan, particularly?
No, not at all. In fact, I'll admit, it's very awful, but I knew almost nothing about Marilyn Monroe. I mean, I knew of her. She's a cultural icon.
Yeah.
I would say she's even gone beyond that now, and she's almost a symbol. So I knew of her. I had seen a few movies that she'd been in. Although, to be honest, whenever I watched those movies, I wasn't really focusing on her because she was sort of in the background.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network.
The Time Is Now, a Millennium podcast, was created by Tony Black and is produced by Tony Black and Kurt North. We can be found on Twitter at The Time Is Now Pod, or by searching Facebook for The Time Is Now. We are part of the We Made This podcast network, which can be found on Twitter at We Made This Pod, or on the website WeMadeThisPod.com. For bonus material and exclusives, check out our sister show, The X-Cast, an X-Files podcast, where you can find our Patreon. This is who we are.